KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Democrats prevailed in Wisconsin. A liberal won a state Supreme Court race despite millions spent by Elon Musk. Republicans kept two congressional seats in Florida. What the elections mean on Morning Edition from NPR News. Today, the Supreme Court considers a bid to deny Medicaid funding to Planned Parenthood. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The money goes for treating low-income patients. South Carolina objects because the organization separately provides abortions. Also, federal prosecutors seek the death penalty for the accused killer of an insurance CEO. And the story of a Canadian actress detained for nearly 2 weeks after asking for a visa. It's Wednesday, April 2nd, which in 1968 is when HAL refused to open the pod bay doors as 2001 premiered. What are you doing, Dave? The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump is poised to impose a set of sweeping new tariffs today on products from all other countries. He says this is the way for the U.S. to regain income and create more American jobs. Many economists say these tariffs could lead to a recession. Diane Swonk is chief economist for KPMG U.S. She says tariffs also bring unintended consequences, just like some tariffs during Trump's first term in office.
We know, for instance, from the 2018-2019 tariffs, higher tariffs on steel did create more jobs in the steel sector, but at the expense of overall manufacturing jobs because inputs costs went up and manufacturers actually slipped into a manufacturing recession.
She spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Two members of the U.S. House of Representatives have brought business in that chamber to a halt for the rest of the week. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports they're fighting to pass bills letting new parents cast votes remotely in the House.
Florida Republican Anna Paulina Luna and Colorado Democrat Brittany Patterson are trying to change House rules so that new parents could vote by proxy for up to 12 weeks around the birth of a child. GOP leaders opposed their bill and designed a measure to kill it, but nine Republicans joined all House Democrats to defeat their effort. Luna says it's a win for parents.
Today is a pretty historical day for the entire conference. It's showing that the body has decided that parents deserve a voice in Washington and also to the importance of female members having a vote in Washington, D.C.
The vote also blocked action on all other bills scheduled for this week. House Speaker Mike Johnson said he was disappointed. He said leaders would regroup and try again to block them next week. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
Voters in Wisconsin have chosen the liberal-backed candidate to fill an open seat on the state's Supreme Court. From member station WUWM, Mayan Silva reports on the Wisconsin judicial race that drew tens of millions of dollars in outside funding and attention from President Trump.
Susan Crawford touted her common sense and experience representing Planned Parenthood and labor interests. Her opposition, Brad Schimmel, was endorsed by Trump and funded to the tune of at least $25 million by billionaire Elon Musk. Voters like Serena Sato, who knocked on doors for Crawford, said that the message is that democracy wins and that Musk and Trump's actions are deeply unpopular.
When we talked to people over and over, they were furious with what they are doing to the federal government, furious that Musk is trying to buy their votes.
Spending in the race is expected to tally in at more than $100 million, the most expensive judicial race in American history. For NPR News, I'm Ayan Silver in Milwaukee.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Republicans Jimmy Patronis and Randy Fine have won a pair of special U.S. House elections held yesterday in Florida. They were endorsed by President Trump. But the Republicans' margins of victory against their Democratic opponents were much smaller than seen in prior elections. Parts of the Northern Plains and the Great Lakes are under winter storm warnings and advisories this morning. That includes Michigan. Nearly 100,000 Michigan customers are still out of power. They lost it last weekend in ice storms that left 7 people dead in the region. 3 of the victims were Michigan children. Nearly 30 years ago, listeners around the world fell in love with the Buena Vista Social Club. The band featured Cuban musicians in their 70s and 80s playing old classics. Now their story is being told on Broadway, as NPR's Isabel Gomez Sarmiento reports.
Like in real life, the musical behind Buena Vista Social Club is about a music producer trying to assemble a group of older musicians to record an album. Artists like pianist Rubén González, guitarist Compay Segundo, and singer Ibrahim Ferrer were all performers in 1950s Havana. But after the Cuban Revolution, many musicians had to look for other jobs to make a living. It wasn't until the 1990s, when they formed Buena Vista Social Club and released an album with the same name, that they achieved international success. The Broadway musical takes creative liberties with the characters, but the music remains at the heart of their story. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. It's a big day on President Trump's calendar, something he's been calling Liberation Day.
A day when he says he's going to make good on a promise to impose tariffs on many, many countries.
I think people will be pleasantly surprised, but it's going to make our country very rich because we're the piggy bank that everybody steals from, and they've been doing it for many years, for decades, and we're not going to let it happen.
The president says he's made up his mind on which tariffs to impose where, although we don't know the details yet. Markets have been nervous leading up to this day amid concerns that taxes on imports hurt rather than help the U.S. economy and also raise consumer prices.
NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben is here to tell us what to expect. Good morning, Danielle.
Hey, good morning.
What do we know about these tariffs?
Well, we know Trump's going to lay them out at a big Rose Garden event at 4 p.m. Eastern, but his team has given few details on this. He and his advisors, in fact, were still working on the tariffs yesterday, which is itself notable. I mean, this is a potentially sweeping trade policy that has not been clearly communicated yet. But as for what he's announcing, these are what he's been calling reciprocal tariffs, which he has said could apply to many different items and all countries. And he's long described them as mirroring other countries' tariffs.
So give us an example there.
Sure. So this week, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt showed reporters a graphic of all kinds of tariffs on U.S. goods. And one example was Mexico's 150% tariff on American alcohol. So a reciprocal tariff in this example could be the U.S. imposing a 150% tariff on Mexican alcohol. Now, again, I want to stress this is just a hypothetical I'm giving, but in this example, that would mean U.S. importers would pay a 150% tax to bring that alcohol into the country. And in most cases, we could expect American businesses to either eat that cost or pass it on to consumers.
Okay, so that sounds like it could get pretty expensive.
Yeah, it could. And stock markets and consumers are taking Trump seriously on this. Consumer confidence and stock indexes have been plummeting as reciprocal tariff day has grown closer. And amid that, Trump seems to have softened on this idea of equal tariffs. Here he was talking to reporters this week.
They took advantage of us, and we are going to be very nice by comparison to what they were. The numbers will be lower than what they've been charging us.
And yesterday, Levitt also said different countries have been lobbying the president's team. Trump has left the door open to exceptions, but he has also said he doesn't want many.
Okay, given that we don't know the details of these tariffs, do we know anything about how they'll affect people here in the U.S.?
Well, we have some broad ideas. One is that they'll lead to higher prices. The Yale Budget Lab did one hypothetical modeling of what these tariffs could look like, finding that in the short run, they'd cost the average household around $3,000 a year. And those costs, by the way, would hit lower income households harder than higher income.
Okay, if this is so risky for the economy, what has the president said about why he's doing this?
Well, the Trump administration says this is about fairness and also about creating manufacturing jobs. That's what Trump ran on, and a lot of his base is in blue-collar jobs like manufacturing. And some manufacturers could be helped by the tariffs. I mean, if goods from other countries get more expensive, it would mean people in the U.S. would buy more goods made in the U.S. But some U.S. manufacturers will also pay more for materials, which could offset whatever benefits they might see from the tariffs. And there's one more economic risk, and that's that other countries see this and then they retaliate with their own tariffs. And farmers would be a likely target there. So there's a real risk here for Trump. He has acknowledged that these tariffs could cause short-term pain, and that means voters could easily, in the future, pin any weakness from the economy on him.
NPR's Daniel Kurzleben. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
Three elections yesterday offered a chance to see how some voters feel about the second Trump administration. Republicans held on to a pair of congressional seats in conservative districts in Florida, although Republicans worried more than expected. In Wisconsin, a liberal candidate for the state Supreme Court easily defeated a conservative backed by Elon Musk. J. Miles Coleman is an elections analyst at the University of Virginia and is following all this. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad you're with us. What do you make of the results?
So overall, not too different from a lot of these special elections we've had since Trump entered office, really, the first time. Again, you know, thinking of those two elections in Florida, you know, the Democrats hoped that they could pick off at least one, but the reality was those districts were so red that they were starting off from so much of a hole. However, they still beat the spread, so to speak, probably the district that got more attention, Congressional District 6, they cut the margin from Trump plus 30 to Republican plus 15. I think that really helps explain why towards the end of last week, one of the big bits of news was Representative Elise Stefanik withdrew her nomination. And I think the thinking behind the scenes was, okay, well, if Republicans keep putting up these big underperformances, a district like hers might be sort of on the bubble in a special election.
I think we should just explain this for people who don't follow it every day. Elise Stefanik was the nominee for United Nations ambassador. She would have had to give up her seat in Congress, leading to another special election. And Republicans, looking at how things are going, thought they might not win that much closer district. What do you make of the results in Wisconsin, where Susan Crawford will become the Supreme Court Justice, the next Supreme Court Justice, a liberal who defeated a conservative in a very, very expensive race?
Yeah, well, what was interesting is, so if you look at these state Supreme Court races in Wisconsin, the Democrats or the more left-leaning candidates have now won four of the past five contests there, and they've all been by about exactly the same 10-point margin. So, like, in a way, it wasn't inconsistent with everything else, but for how much money that was kind of spent there, that things didn't really move that much. One thing that I would watch for now going forward because of this selection is because the liberal justices are going to keep their majority on the court. When they first got their majority a few years ago, they redrew the legislative maps, and the thinking seems to be, well, the House map could be next. Even though Wisconsin is typically a 50-50 state, the Republicans have 6 of the 8 seats in the House there. That was one reason why people like Elon Musk got so involved in this election, because of its national implications. So that's definitely something to be looking out for over this next judicial term or so.
Yeah, I guess we should note Elon Musk showed up in Wisconsin, offered money to voters, spent $25 million, although the Democrats also spent many, many millions as well. Thanks very much for the time, J. Miles Coleman of the University of Virginia. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's a truly amazing thing. After talking on the Senate floor for slightly more than 25 hours, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker met reporters in a hallway to talk some more.
Very sore and weary and tired, and but I'm enormously grateful for a lot of folks who sent me their very, very personal stories. They gave me a chance to speak to the pain, hurt, fear, anger, demands of a lot of Americans.
Booker's speech broke the previous record set in 1957 by Senator Strom Thurmond, who opposed a civil rights bill back then for slightly over 24 hours.
I just found it strange that he had the record. And as a guy who's grew up with the legends of the civil rights movement myself, of my parents and other their friends, it just would seem wrong to me, always seemed wrong.
All right, I can't say I watched the whole speech, but I checked in from time to time. Booker was speaking to protest many actions by the Trump administration. Let's hear a fraction of the points that Booker made. Around 3:30 yesterday afternoon, he was talking about the tariffs the president is promising to announce today, a day that Trump labeled Liberation Day.
I just feel that Trump mocks us. What does his Liberation Day mean to the people that are shackled to debt, from medical debt, that are shackled with student debt, that can't afford the rising cost of groceries? What does liberation mean to people who are chained by fear right now, waiting with bated breath to see if the Medicaid programs they rely on are going to be cut? What does his liberation mean to people who are literally in jails right now because they were disappeared from our streets? What does his liberation mean to people who can't afford homes because of his tariffs, who dreamed of a new car, but that's going to go up as well? I don't know what he means by liberation. I honestly don't. I wish he'd explain it to the American people. Who's liberated in this financial times? Who's liberated?
He sounded a little weary at this point, about 20 hours in, but seemed to gain more energy on the way to the finish. A little after 7 last night, he broke the record to applause in the chamber and congratulations even from a few Republicans. And then he said he wanted to go on just a little more.
Let's be bolder in America. With a vision that inspires, with hope, that starts with the people of the United States of America. That's how this country started. We, the people. Let's get back to the ideals that others are threatening. Let's get back to our founding documents, that those imperfect geniuses had some very special words at the end of the Declaration of Independence. It was one of the greatest in all of humanity, declarations of interdependence. When our founders said we must mutually pledge to each other, our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. We need that now from all Americans. This is a moral moment. It's not left or right. It's right or wrong. Let's get in good trouble. My friend, Madam President, I yield the floor.
That was about 5 minutes after 8 o'clock last night. Although the speech did not pass or block any legislation, it seized attention, something Democrats have struggled to do. This is NPR News.
Thank you. on the next Fresh Air. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is in force, and students are in the crosshairs at college campuses nationwide, from Columbia to the University of Alabama. Legal scholar Daniel Canstrom joins us to unpack the law, the history, and the human cost. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. For most of her life, Jasmine Mooney has been crossing back and forth between her native Canada and the U.S., including working in California until last year when her visa was revoked. Then she got a new job in the U.S. So last month, the Canadian actress and entrepreneur went to the San Ysidro Port of Entry at the border of Mexico and California with her paperwork to get a new visa. What happened next is something she never could have imagined.
They took me, they took all of my luggage, they took my phone, my hands against the wall.
She doesn't have a criminal record and assumed, based on a lawyer's advice, that if there was an issue, she'd be allowed to go back to Mexico and then home to Canada. Instead, she was detained for 12 days. When she was released, she wrote about her experience for The Guardian. It started with 48 hours in a holding cell.
They handed me this little mat and this aluminum foil thing that you use as a blanket. You wrap it around yourself like a dead body because it's so cold in the cells, and you just lay there. I laid on the cement floor for 2 days, and no one told me what was going on.
On the third day, she was allowed her first phone call.
So I called my best friend, also because you don't have your phone. Like, you can't look at phone numbers. So thank God I remembered her phone number. And so I was like, you need to call my lawyers, you need to call my family, you need to get a hold of anyone, any of our friends that can help me in this situation.
So then you go from there and you're transferred, right?
Yes. Yeah, so after that, then I am in an office talking to this officer. She has a bunch of paperwork, and they said I was being banned for 5 years. I have the chance to appeal, but I'm, as of now, banned. And then that's when I got transferred to the jail in San Diego.
The Otay Mesa Detention Center.
Yeah. It's a full day of onboarding. They put you in the prison outfit. And then I got put into jail with all the other girls. So there was like 150 of us in this prison.
Who was in this detention center with you?
Every single woman in my unit. None of us had a criminal record.
So what were you all doing there?
So everyone had a different story. A lot of them had working visas, and then they reapplied and were denied, or their visas expired. Everyone had a different story.
So before you got detained, had you ever thought about these detention facilities and this immigration system and what you were seeing when you got there?
I knew nothing. It's something I never thought about before, truly. You hear some stories like crossing the borders illegally, like physically sneaking in, but never firsthand when you're in it and seeing how they treat these people, again, who have no criminal record. And then the biggest thing for me is like, okay, if you don't want us, if you don't want us in your country, if we're all getting deported, why are you keeping us in here for this long? Why is it that me, as a Canadian citizen with a Canadian passport who offered to pay for her flight home, why am I in here for 2 weeks?
While friends, family, and colleagues went to the press to tell her story, Mooney was transferred again to a detention facility in Arizona where she says she was held with 30 other women in a cell.
Everyone in there were my cheerleaders trying to get me out because they're like, you're the only one that's like, we believe that you can use your voice and help us and help everyone in here.
Why did they believe that about you and not them?
I think they just, you know, they were from all over the world. They had spoken out against their countries. They had come from Iran, India, Africa, and they're like, no one's going to listen to us, but we feel like people are going to listen to you.
What were some of their stories?
So I became really close with someone from India and then another woman from Iran, and they had very similar stories. They saw something that was not right in their countries, and they used their voices, and they got in a lot of trouble. And so they both sold everything they owned, and they're spending like $60,000, okay? That is a lot of money.
To try to get to the U.S. You were told at one point that you should prepare to be detained for months, and ultimately you were detained for 12 days.
Yes.
What got you out sooner, do you think?
Listen, I had the media, I had politicians advocating for me, I had lawyers, I had everything that I could possibly get, I had working for me. So you can only imagine what all these other people have, which is nothing. They do not have my privilege, right?
Now, you came out with letters from other women in detention. Mm-hmm. Why did they give them to you, and what did you do with them?
Well, when we first got in there, because we weren't given access to the phone.
This is in Arizona.
They were just scared. They were so scared. They didn't know what was going on. And they were like, you for sure are getting out of here before any of us. So if we still haven't been able to get a hold of our families, like, please give them this message, essentially.
So it feels like you came out with a mission.
You know what? It was funny. I've never written anything before. And when I got out, I wrote my essay flying home on the plane. I was like, I need to share this. I need to tell people that this is happening. I don't know what it will do. Maybe no one will even listen, but I need to try. This isn't just my story. This is happening very regularly now.
Jasmine Mooney is the co-founder of the beverage company Holy Water and a Canadian actress. Jasmine, thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
When we asked about Mooney's detention, U.S. Customs and Border Protection Assistant Commissioner Hilton Beckham said in a statement that the agency cannot disclose details about specific cases, and a spokesperson for Immigration and Customs Enforcement said Mooney was detained for not having legal documentation to be in the U.S. This is NPR News.
Spring has sprung. It's the perfect time to go outside and dive into a great book, like King of Ashes by S.A. Cosby.
That's a Southern crime drama inspired by The Godfather. You know, there's like an ailing patriarch, a family that's falling apart, and a son just to come back and pull everything together.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Fiction for Spring on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. At the White House today, President Trump is expected to begin rolling out additional tariffs on imports of foreign-made goods. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, the president backs tariffs as a way to incentivize more companies to do business in the U.S.
President Trump has been hyping up this day for weeks, saying tariffs will boost the U.S. economy, even though most economists say the cost of tariffs will be paid by American consumers. Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt says one of Trump's goals is to build back a domestic manufacturing base in the U.S.
It's simple. If you make your product in America, you will pay no tariffs.
Manufacturing in the U.S., however, is generally more expensive. Leavitt says tariffs will take effect immediately, though Trump has also said he is open to negotiation. So whatever is announced today may not be where the tariffs ultimately land. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The White House.
The president's 25% tariffs on imports of foreign vehicles and certain auto parts take effect tomorrow. The National Weather Service says areas of the Midwest and South are likely to see some rough weather today, including potentially deadly flash flooding and the possibility of tornadoes with baseball-sized hail. Western areas of Kentucky and Tennessee are among those at high risk. This is NPR News. There is word from Los Angeles this morning that actor Val Kilmer has died. His daughter says Kilmer died of pneumonia at the age of 65. As Steve Futterman reports, Kilmer rose to fame in the 1980s after playing the naval aviator Iceman in the first Top Gun movie.
For many, their initial memory of Val Kilmer came in the first of the Top Gun movies in 1986. He played the nemesis of Tom Cruise.
You figured it out yet? What's that? Who's the best pilot?
One of his most memorable roles was his portrayal of Jim Morrison, the lead singer of The Doors.
I'm the poet and you're my muse.
Kilmer appeared in dozens of other films, including Tombstone, Willow, and Batman Forever. There were also TV roles and appearances on stage. Although highly acclaimed as an actor, Kilmer could reportedly at times be difficult to work with, and he faced serious health challenges, including a battle with throat cancer, which affected his voice. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
For the first time, the average Major League Baseball player is being paid more than $5 million a year. That's according to a study by the Associated Press. Topping the list is New York Mets outfielder Juan Soto, who's making nearly $62 million this season. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today, the Supreme Court hears arguments in a case that is about abortion and also not about abortion. South Carolina wants to remove Planned Parenthood clinics from providing services under its Medicaid program because Planned Parenthood also provides abortions that are not covered by Medicaid. Here's NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
Planned Parenthood South Atlantic has long operated two clinics in South Carolina that provide essential medical care for low-income patients through Medicaid. Among the services provided are physical exams, cancer screenings, and screenings for such conditions as diabetes, anemia, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure. The centers also cater to low-income patients by providing flexible hours, same-day appointments, and comprehensive contraception care in a single appointment, as well as interpreter services. Separately, and not covered by Medicaid, the health centers do provide abortion services to the limited extent permissible under state law, that is, during the first 6 weeks of pregnancy. In 2018, South Carolina's Republican governor issued an executive order terminating Planned Parenthood's participation in the state's Medicaid program because of its separately funded abortions. In a state with a significant shortage of primary care providers, that meant many low-income residents who used Planned Parenthood for their health care would be out of luck. And Planned Parenthood, which operates on a thin financial margin, would have to close its doors. So the clinics challenged their removal from the state's Medicaid program, and they won. The lower courts repeatedly ruled that the federal Medicaid law specifically requires that patients have a right to go to any qualified and willing medical provider, and that Planned Parenthood South Atlantic was and is a qualified provider. Lawyer Nicole Saharsky represents Planned Parenthood.
The Congress made this determination that even when a person is insured through Medicare and Medicaid, the state isn't going to dictate which doctor they can go to. Like people who are on private insurance, they can go to any qualified and willing provider. Medical decisions are intensely personal. So this has been a requirement of federal law for over 50 years.
Lawyer John Bursch, representing the state of South Carolina, maintains that the federal regulation that interprets the statute does allow states to disqualify a provider for any reason. And the reason is, as he puts it,
the taxpayers don't want their Medicaid dollars going to an organization that is taking unborn lives.
Bursch says it is a misnomer to call the part of the Medicaid law at issue in today's case the free choice of provider provision.
The word free isn't in the statute. The word choice isn't in the statute. They're just making those words up.
That's all smoke and mirrors, counters lawyer Saharsky.
South Carolina has conceded throughout this litigation that Planned Parenthood is a medically qualified provider. It's just we don't like Planned Parenthood.
So as the state comes to the Supreme Court, the question is, how can Planned Parenthood enforce the Medicaid provision that requires the state to pay every qualified provider for Medicaid services? The state's lawyer, John Bursch, will tell the justices that under the Medicaid statute, neither patients nor providers have any right to enforce the Medicaid law. He contends that the only remedy the statute provides is for patients and providers to appeal to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, asking him to take away all the state's Medicaid funding until it complies.
That has essentially never happened.
Again, Nicole Saharsky.
Because it would hurt the very people that the state and that the United States are supposed to be helping, folks who are living in poverty.
So instead, Planned Parenthood and one of its Medicaid patients are suing to enforce her rights to get medical care from Planned Parenthood. South Carolina maintains the federal Medicaid law simply doesn't permit such individual enforcement of rights. Again, John Bursch.
The Medicaid Act gives states substantial flexibility. When it comes to qualifications, the state can disqualify for any reason that state law allows.
Lower courts in this and other cases have referred to Medicaid as a bargain for states, under which, in South Carolina's case, it gets 70% of its Medicaid funds from the federal government, and in exchange it must live up to the conditions specified in the law, including Medicaid reimbursement for any qualified provider. That said, in recent years, the conservative Supreme Court has rarely granted an individual right to sue as an enforcement mechanism. If the court rules that South Carolina can remove Planned Parenthood from its roster of qualified medical providers, many other states will follow, and Medicaid patients will have far fewer places to go for medical care. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The 26-year-old man accused of killing an insurance executive last year is facing the most serious possible punishment. If Luigi Mangione is convicted in federal court, he could get the death penalty. Samantha Max of member station WNYC reports.
Attorney General Pam Bondi says pursuing the death penalty against Mangione is part of President Trump's agenda to make America safe again. The death penalty is no longer an option in New York state courts, but it is still allowed under federal law, and Trump has repeatedly expressed his support for the death penalty. Here he is addressing Congress in March.
I have already signed an executive order requiring a mandatory death penalty for anyone who murders a police officer, and tonight I'm asking Congress to pass that policy into permanent law.
Trump issued that executive order on his first day in office, calling for capital punishment for what he described as horrible acts of violence against Americans. Federal prosecutors charged Mangione with stalking and killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson outside a New York City hotel last December. He has not entered a plea in that case. He has pleaded not guilty to various state charges that carry a maximum sentence of life in prison.
It's not a surprise to me that they're seeking the death penalty.
Attorney Bernard Harcourt represents defendants in death penalty cases. He says Mangione's case aligns with the president's ideological agenda.
It was an attack on the insurance industry, on a CEO. It was an attack, in a way, on the capitalist system.
Mangione has become something of a folk hero for people who are disillusioned with the American health insurance industry. But law enforcement officials have criticized the public obsession. NYPD Commissioner Jessica Tisch has called the shooting a cold and calculated crime.
We don't celebrate murders, and we don't lionize the killing of anyone. And any attempt to rationalize this is vile, reckless, and offensive to our deeply held principles of justice.
During Trump's first term, his administration executed 13 people. Now there are only 3 people left on federal death row. That's because former President Joe Biden commuted everyone else's sentences to life in prison just weeks before he left office. Mangione's attorney says the decision to seek the death penalty in his case is political, and that her client is being treated like a trophy. For NPR News, I'm Samantha Max in New York.
This is NPR News.
As the number of unemployed government workers grows, so do the number of job scams targeting personal information and money. That's next time, here and now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. You ever seen something so cute you felt overwhelmed? There's a word for that feeling, gigil. That's a Tagalog word from the Philippines, and it's one of the words and phrases added to the Oxford English Dictionary from languages other than English. Words without direct translations, and also some phrases. If someone, for example, is being very, very foolish, you can borrow from the Irish and tell them to stop acting the maggot. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Springtime is officially here, and a new season means a new crop of books we're looking forward to. Here to shout out some nonfiction books is Andrew Limbong. He hosts NPR's Book of the Day podcast. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Layla.
Okay, so I'm excited to hear what I should read for the spring. Mm-hmm. So between now and June, we've got some memoir, some reportage. Where do you want to start?
Let's start with the biggest book of the bunch, and I mean that quite literally. The Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Ron Chernow's got a new book coming out in May. This is the guy that wrote definitive biographies of George Washington, Ulysses S. Grant, and of course Alexander Hamilton. That last book inspired a musical you might have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Chernow's got a new book coming out, and it's called Mark Twain. And this bad boy is like 1,200 pages long. So, you know, it's one of those books you really got to settle into. But I think Chernow's resume proves that it'll be time well spent.
So let's stay in the biography lane for a bit. You flagged mm-hmm. another book that's a deep look at a polarizing figure.
Yeah, this one comes from another Pulitzer winner, Robin Givhan. She's the fashion critic at the Washington Post. And she's coming out with a book called Make It Ours, which is a biography of the fashion designer Virgil Abloh, who died in 2021 when he was 41 years old. Now, he was the first Black American to become an artistic director at the luxury fashion brand Louis Vuitton. And even before that, his brand Off-White was all about making people think about what counts as quote-unquote high fashion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So his whole career was this mishmash of streetwear, hip-hop culture, postmodernism, corporate branding. You know, all that is to say, even if you don't care about what's going on the runway, right?
Yeah.
I think learning about Abloh is a unique way to understand popular culture at large.
And speaking of popular culture, any celebrity memoirs you're looking forward to?
All right, Layla. So I'm a 35-year-old man who still thinks fart jokes are funny,
okay,
right?
And
so
thank you for the context.
It's no surprise, yeah, that the band Blink-182 played a very important part in my life. And so I was stoked to hear Mark Hoppus, the bassist, has a new memoir coming out this week. It's titled Fahrenheit 182. And he goes through the band's come up, the highs of the MTV era, and then the cancer he was diagnosed with a few years ago. But I got to take an early look at it, and it's really this touching look at his friendship with Tom DeLonge, the other guitarist and other vocalist in the band. You know, they go through their ups and downs like you do in any long-term relationship. And I think fans of the band will appreciate how open Hoppus is about stuff like, oh, you know, when this happened, that hurt my feelings. Or when that happened, I was the one being a jerk.
I mean, I love a good memoir.
Mm-hmm.
I also, a bad memoir is pretty tough. So what about memoirs, though, from non-celebs?
I don't know if you remember that book, Blankets, that came out in 2003.
Yeah.
That was the graphic memoir by cartoonist Craig Thompson. And it still comes up in the news from time to time for being pulled from library shelves for its sexual content. Thompson's got a new graphic memoir out titled Ginseng Roots, and it's about how he grew up in Wisconsin working on ginseng farms. I didn't know this until reading the book, but apparently Wisconsin is like a top producer of cultivated ginseng, and this book is all about taking this like big global story about trade and agriculture and telling it through the eyes of Thompson as a kid.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more book.
Okay, real quick, this is for like hardcore literature fans.
Mm-hmm.
It's titled Toni at Random by Dana A. Williams, and it's a look at Toni Morrison's editing career.
Oh.
You know, people generally know her as an author of
right.
like The Bluest Eye and Beloved, but this book is all about Morrison's time at Random House and how she was picking projects and working behind the scenes editing writers like Muhammad Ali and Angela Davis.
Andrew Limbong, host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Layla.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. More than half of states in the United States have made marijuana legal for medical or recreational use. But it's still illegal on the federal level, which means it's up to the states to figure out how to regulate everything from vape pens to popcorn sprinkled with THC. Really? That's a thing? As part of our How Safe Is Your Weed series, NPR's Sydney Lupkin went to one of the world's major weed markets, California.
At Vibe Cultivators, an indoor cannabis farm in Sacramento, the first thing to hit you is the smell. Earthy, skunky, whatever you want to call it, that is some pungent weed. There are aisles of plants growing on two levels under artificial lights.
This room is probably a week or two from being harvested.
That's Brian Pritchard giving me the tour. Every plant has a state-sanctioned blue tag with an ID number. It's a sign that this isn't weed grown by a guy who knows a guy. California legalized recreational marijuana in 2016. Pritchard remembers what it was like back when he had to be quiet about his work.
Before, I'd go to Home Depot and I'd tell them, oh, I need this part and this part to make something. Well, they want to know what I'm making. Well, I can't tell you what I'm making. I just need these parts. Now it's a lot more open.
Now he can just ask for guidance, even from state regulators. In California, that's the Department of Cannabis Control, or DCC. One of its duties is to keep contaminants out, whether that's bacteria, mold, pesticides, or even heavy metals like arsenic. That's because for cannabis, unlike for food or prescription drugs, there's no FDA to keep consumers safe. In that vacuum, weed regulators from several states launched the Cannabis Regulators Association to help each other out. Jillian Schauer is the executive director.
States were struggling to set up literally their own mini FDAs and mini EPAs to try to do the due diligence that was needed.
The states share information, but they don't all test for the same things. In California, the DCC tracks almost every step in the cannabis pipeline. Weed manufacturers even have to report how many pounds of plant trimmings they throw away. Sarah Ruiz oversees inspection teams at the DCC.
We are inhaling these products, and we know how sensitive our respiratory systems are. We all remember the Avalli crisis.
The Avalli crisis was a 2019 outbreak of lung injuries and hospitalizations across all 50 states linked to vape products. At least 68 people died. The possible health risks of weed aren't confined to smoking. The DCC also regulates edibles like gummies, brownies, and sodas. Down the street from the Sacramento pot farm, there's a factory that makes a product called Wild Gummies. It was a grapefruit day, and I watched as a machine poured the solution into rectangular molds. Everyone is wearing hairnets, masks, and blue gloves. Gabe Parton-Lee is the company's attorney.
Every single batch goes to a lab. So after it's cured, after its final package goes to distribution, then it goes out to testing.
The finished gummies are tested at one of 27 licensed labs around the state before they reach consumers. Overseeing all the labs is this one in Richmond, near San Francisco, the official lab of the Department of Cannabis Control. I watch research scientist Adam Malinowski take a sample of ground-up marijuana leaves. He's going to put it with a growth medium to see if any mold appears.
These are how we incubate our cannabis samples. So we take 1 gram of cannabis and we place it in this stomaching bag. Basically, it has a membrane to divide it, so you can put your cannabis on one side and media.
They use sensitive machines to test for hundreds of contaminants. His boss, Antonio Frazier, says over the last 5 years, the regulated marijuana has gotten a lot cleaner.
We test for both products off the legal shelf and for law enforcement and the illicit market, and we see levels of illegal pesticides that are 1,000 times the actual limit coming from the illicit market.
In other words, it's still safer to buy regulated weed than illicit weed, even though it's more expensive. Regulation can also mean recalls. California had 63 last year. That meant sellers had to yank nearly 25,000 individual units of cannabis products from their shelves. Vibe Cultivators didn't have anything recalled. Brian Pritchard says the regulation is doing its job, which helps him do his job.
I don't have to sneak in at midnight to get my work done anymore. It's a major improvement. The only people that are going to complain about it are the people who are doing stuff wrong.
But many here do wish that eventually cannabis will be legal nationwide and regulated that way. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
From California to Queens, New York, where nearly half the residents come from other countries. One international community there meets every month in a church hall to celebrate their culture. Reporter Jeff London went to the New York Indonesian Food Bazaar to check it out.
The church hall in Elmhurst is lined with tables offering various delicacies on the sides of the space and picnic tables in the center filled with people eating those delicacies. Tuti Sumarmi is a tiny woman in a hijab. She's been selling sweet treats and banana leaves, all types of fritters and skewers, since the bazaar began 14 years ago.
I like to meet a friend, new people, and I can promote Indonesian food. And I make money, right?
Promoting Indonesian food is one of the reasons Fifi Anggono, an immigrant from Surabaya, founded the bazaar. It's part of a non-profit organization called Indonesian Culinary Enthusiasts.
We try to introduce the culinary to non-Indonesian people.
There are approximately 10,000 Indonesian immigrants across the New York area, and many come to grab a taste of home. But the bazaar attracts many non-Indonesian people who are just looking to try food they can't get anywhere else. Stephen Raga, the local New York Assembly member for the district, showed up looking for his favorite drink made of cantaloupe and watermelon.
There's such a concentration of diversity here in the Jackson Heights, Woodside, Elmhurst area. Number one, it means there's good food everywhere you go. Number two, you can see that there's different cultures that are not just celebrating their culture and heritage every day, but also just teaching it to a new generation.
Pauline Liao immigrated when she was 2 years old.
I was born in Jakarta, and I would go back growing up every few years. And I don't know, around here, there's not really a lot of Indonesian food. So when I found this on Instagram, I was really delighted.
Liao had several bags of food to take home. She says she had ingredients to make authentic Indonesian cuisine. There was one thing she was on the hunt for.
I love the desserts. Yeah. So for me, all the desserts I love.
Including a particular honeycomb cake from Sumatra, which I tried. It had a spongy texture and was not too sweet. Like most of the food I ate at the New York Indonesian Food Bazaar, it was delicious. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in Elmhurst, Queens, New York.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lila Falted.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Just a gigolo, everywhere I go, the people know the part that I'm playing. I am paid for every dance, I sell each romance, every night some heart I'm betraying. Yes, sir, but there'll come a day, I know my youth will pass away, then what'll they say about me? Oh, when the end comes, I know, they'll say just a gigolo.